I'm talking to you from Stroud in Gloucestershire, and Gloucestershire is, well, if you imagine, you know, there's a kind of, England is like a great big boot with a foot on the end of it. It's just right at the bottom of the leg and the front part of it. That's where we are. So we're, and the Bristol Channel runs up along the bottom, the top part of the bottom part of the country, and underneath Wales. And at the end of the Bristol Channel, you come on the Severn River, you come to, just off that, you come to Gloucester.
Okay.
And Gloucester's one of the big strategic cities historically. For example, in the Norman invasion, you know, the area around Gloucester and Bristol is considered to be very strategically important, because if you're moving from the West Country up north, the Romans understood this, you know, you need to come past here. And there was also quite a lot of military around here as well. In Wiltshire is Salisbury Plain, and the city of Salisbury, where we've had all this Skripal stuff, that's not far from here. So it's the sort of heart of the south of England, which has always been, you know, more important strategically than the north. At least it's been seen like it, because most of the wealth's down here. But Stroud is just a few miles east of Gloucester, and it's in the valleys. It's into the Cotswolds. And it was in these valleys, a few hundred years ago, that the Industrial Revolution really started. I mean, it was going on in parallel up north as well, but here was one of the first big mills was ever produced or built. And the idea really was that lots and lots of people used to have weaving, cloth, and all that sort of thing as cottage industries. And but then some bright spark decided, with a bit of money we can build a big mill, and we can make a factory, we can build these big looms, and we can start mass production and production lines for producing cloth. And so that's what they did, and they did it here because there's such a plentiful supply of water. They've got lots of rivers running through the Stroud valleys, and so Dunkirk Mill was one of the first big mills, and that's just down here. And there's something called the Stroud Textiles Trust today, which, even though many of these mills have been converted many years ago into either workspaces, or some of them even into sort of designer living spaces, you know, so basically flats, we call them here, apartments.
Sure, flats, yeah, okay.
And many of them have still got parts of the original mill wheels and things like that working. So, you know, they were multi-story buildings, they were very big, and they employed lots and lots of people around here, but it was really part of the capitalist Industrial Revolution, which was taking the ability to make the money away from individuals in their homes that they were, you know, the cottage industry, and concentrating it all into a big place where one or two owners made lots of money. And of course the end result was that they produced a lot more cloth, and that cloth was, you know, mainly made from wool, was sent out all over the world. In fact, still here, they still just about make cloth here in Stroud. There's only one mill left, and they make some apparently of the finest quality cloth in the world.
And
they make felt and things like that. But, you know, it's quite interesting because the people around here are very much aware of their history. It's a funny place.
Okay.
They're a very switched on lot, and they're very much aware of their history and very active politically. Most of Britain is depoliticised, I would say. Certainly the people just get on with their jobs, they don't really think much about politics. But Stroud is a place where everybody seems to be involved one way or another, almost everyone, in something political.
Really? Okay.
So it's an interesting town, you know, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. But to move on, I mean, I'm particularly concerned about this whole business with Trump and Putin at the moment. I don't know what you think, George.
Yeah. Say that again, Tony.
Do you think that will the White House meeting happen?
Well, I don't know. I was watching the Putin Trump, and Trump misspeaks at times. You know, he pulled a gaffe over there. So. They jumped on it, though.
I mean, I don't know if people think that we're supposed to believe that he really did say the wrong thing accidentally.
Yeah.
I don't believe for one moment that he said it accidentally. I think he was pulled in by the Secret Services and by the powers that be, and he was told, no, you're not allowed to say that. You have to say this.
Yeah. But Putin, we think, gave him some information just between the two of them. That's why they met privately. Okay. So we don't know what's going on behind the scenes exactly.
Well, I mean, I think we have to take a step back from all this, George, and look at the way the world really works.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work the way we're told it in on CNN and on
the BBC. Exactly.
Yeah, so behind the scenes, effectively, in every country now, there's a mafia, a very powerful mafia, and that's the easiest way to describe it, I think, involving sometimes secret societies, certainly involving organized crime, certainly also involving wars and arms dealers and arms sales and bankers. But the I was having a chat with a journalist of yours, a US journalist, Daniel Hopsicker, a few weeks ago, and he said something which I'd never heard anyone else say this, and I think Daniel particularly, he worked with Gary Webb, and as you know, Gary exposed the Iran-Contra, is one of the people that exposed the Iran-Contra affair,
right. Okay.
And was suicided for his trouble, and Daniel was one of the people who was exposing the MENA air base stuff on the other side of the country in Arkansas. So yeah, I mean, I do know a little bit about geography.
Right. Sure.
So you know where Bill Clinton was.
MENA, Arkansas. Yeah.
That's right. And so the two of them are two of the most, you know, I would say significant, important journalistic figures, in Gary and Daniel, in the United States. But of course, they're not really celebrated apart from on the sort of fringes and on the internet, because the mainstream press is so utterly controlled by these gangsters that they want to shut honest journalists like Gary Webb and like Daniel Hopsicker out.
Right.
So, you know, having a chat with Daniel, what he said to me was, you know, the first industry to globalize was organized crime.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right about that. So when you're looking at Putin and Trump, in fact, you know, whichever leaders we're talking about, but particularly let's just focus on Putin and Trump. What we're seeing there really is two people who are not necessarily controlled by organized crime, but that is the world, the milieu that they're moving around in. So they're the people who are advising them, very close to them, telling them what to do, you know, maybe their lawyers, all these sorts of people who are close to them, are gangsters. I mean, we're talking about people who are maybe have gone through the Mafia Omerta oath system. Maybe there's just, you know, some sort of Masonic thing involved, but they are people who are having to deal with this international mafia. Now, there are different factions within it, of course, as well. So I think when Putin meets Trump, what we get is we get two people from different factions that are both actually watching around to see, you know, is anybody going to try and kill me, you know, dispatch me. And these people, okay, so they're very powerful world leaders. They know that there are also other ruthless people out there,
right,
that might wish to dispatch them. I mean, we've got all this kind of judicial, the appalling Robert Mueller case, which is just, I think, totally disgusting, which is trying to fit Putin up for the crimes of his own friends, who were the, you know, the crooked Hillary Clintonites, who stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders, and then Seth Rich, the Democratic at the DNC, who was then murdered because he'd leaked these emails. This is certainly the way it looks through, and this is why they've closed down Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. He's not allowed to use the internet. He's one of the most important brokers of these honest stories around the world,
right.
And because he did this along with Craig Murray and managed to get these emails out, which was showing utter corruption at the heart of the Democratic nomination process. So, you know, this is why Trump is in a difficult situation. So there are very powerful factions who can tell him what to do, but then he can also take a trip to Helsinki like he did, which was great to see, and Putin kept him waiting, which is I suppose showing the whole world who's really actually the boss. And but Putin has got a right to do that, really, because the way he's been playing all this international the manoeuvrings has actually been pretty masterful. He's blocked this war on terror, which was always only an excuse to destabilise the Middle East for the benefit of the Israelis, and very, very slowly and surely and smartly and firmly, Putin has blocked it. He stopped it, and in Syria. So I would suggest that what you're probably getting between the private conversations between Putin and Trump are very important conversations, where Putin is saying, right, Donald, you know, we know this, and we know this, and we know this. And this is probably a revelation. I mean, talking about corruption within his own country.
Right.
Various plans which are being, you know, cooked up to get rid of Trump. This kind of thing. You know, smear campaigns. Psychological warfare. And that is the sort of thing I would imagine would be involved in that conversation. This is why Trump needs to get away to somewhere like Helsinki. So right. He really can be alone with Putin, because what the deep state in the US is trying to do is to try and totally preclude that possibility. So I think
right.
Trump, you know, for all his failings, has done a really good job in making sure that he's had one-to-one conversations with the man that many people in the United States deep state just want him to have a war with, effectively. I mean, not necessarily a fighting, shooting war, but they don't want those two heads to meet, and Trump has gone out of his way to make sure they do. So full marks for Trump for doing that.
Well, you know, what I think now on this last indictment of these 12 Russians, Mueller's going to use that to close down the investigation, okay? Because the 12 Russians will never appear in court. So it's a good way to close it down and then say to our public, the American public, we were right, there was Russian involvement in disrupting our election. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, then Putin has now said, well, you can send your investigators over to Russia and they can interview them here. It's very much like the whole Julian Assange.
Well, that's not going to fly. They're not going to go with that. Nobody. Either side.
Why not? Are they scared? Why won't they go?
Well, I think it was just a possibility that was put forward, but neither side wants to do that now. Not really.
I mean, it's a bit like the British, you know, the appalling treatment that Julian Assange has got in London.
Yeah.
You know, they said, well, if the Swedish want to interview him, they can come to London. We don't actually trust handing him over to another jurisdiction, who may then hand him to the United States. So, you know, what you've got is a ridiculous situation, so that there is a real breakdown of trust, I guess. But if there was any real attempt to get justice, and if they really believe what they were saying, they would come over, and they would fly over to Russia, and they would interview these people, see if they could gather any more evidence, and then fly home again.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're afraid that they might be arrested while they're over there or something, or taken hostage. How ridiculous is that? I mean, you know, if they were really interested in getting to the truth, they would do that. But they're not interested in getting to the truth. This is just another stupid, cooked-up story, just like the Skripal story, in order to try and discredit Russia. It's called
right.
Operation Beluga. It's called Operation Beluga, and it's a NATO operation right across the NATO countries to destabilise and discredit Putin. They're going to try to do to Putin what they did to Colonel Gaddafi, destabilise him, and eventually, you know, they don't care if he dies or not. They're not interested in that. They just want to destabilise him to control his country. But they're not going, obviously, to manage it with Putin. So they're basically banging their heads against a brick wall.
Well, this last indictment of this woman, this Russian, that was connected to the National Rifle Association, that's just another put-up job to discredit the Russians and Putin. See? Okay?
Yeah, well, that's quite true. I mean, I don't know if you know, there's a thing about the NRA.
Yeah. Well,
there's a new series, a comedy series out, or it's a satirical comedy series out, called, I think it's called This Is America.
Yeah.
Have you seen that, George?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen that.
Right. Well, it's done by a guy called Sacha Baron Cohen, and he's also known as Ali G. You'll see him. He's had TV programs, certainly here in the UK. I'm not sure if they've been shown in the US. But he's moved to the US now, and he's doing this satirical program. So what he's done is he's got a fake campaign, basically, and he's gone to the National Rifle Association saying, I've got a great campaign here, which we've been running in Israel, and he's saying that children as young as three should be given guns. Now, for some rather naive members of the NRA, they've been going along with this, yeah?
Yeah.
Saying this is a great idea, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he's just winding them up. He's just making fun of them and filming them for his TV show.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about now, yeah.
Yeah, so, number one, it is quite funny, but I look at it and I think it's actually really deeply sinister, actually. I was having a chat with an author here in Britain, a commentator, David Southwell. He's the author of, really, a book everybody should have a copy of in their home. It's the Conspiracy Bible. It's called Secrets and Lies.
Yeah.
And he goes through just about every single conspiracy you could possibly imagine in that book, and he's got a page on each one, and enough information for you to follow up what he's saying about it.
Okay.
It's brilliant. And, you know, it's by far the best. If you haven't got a copy, George, get yourself it. It's just a mind-blower. It's a sort of coffee table book that,
okay,
you know, everyone should have. Anyway, he's also done a more, I suppose, more scholarly book, which is called The History of Organized Crime.
Okay.
And David's comments on this comedy program, I thought, were absolutely apposite. He said it's the greatest steal in comedy history because he's pinched the entire format from a guy actually I used to work with, funnily enough, at the BBC in 1989 and 1990 at Marylebone High Street in Greater London Radio, which is a guy called Chris Morris. And Chris had his own show, I think it was on a Saturday lunchtime when I was there, and the whole thing was just a complete wind-up from start to finish. The guy is basically a broadcasting genius. And he went on from radio, and I was working in local radio, into network radio across the country, and then he went on to do a very well-known series called The Day Today. Now, The Day Today is really just a poking fun at the news. The way the news presenters take themselves so seriously, then they have all sorts of ridiculous news stories that you're supposed to believe.
Yeah.
They even filmed a fantastic session where the news presenter is in a bad mood, and he gets these two, there's a sort of peace process going on, and he gets two representatives from each side of the peace process rowing and shouting with each other, and then he says, and what are you going to do about it, you know? And the other guy says, well, I suppose we might say it. He says, say it, say it. We might have to have a war.
Yeah.
and then he cuts to this guy out in the field, and the first bombs are being fired in this war. So they've actually created a war on this TV show by getting these two guys to row with each other. So you can see the kind of crazy satire it is. Sacha Baron Cohen, with his This Is America series, has completely stolen this format, and he's using it for his own ends. And it's rather sinister, really, because he's using it as a way of making fun of the people who are saying, talking about the school shootings.
I see.
And let's be honest about this. Those school shootings are perpetrated by the deep state, which includes the Israelis, obviously. And this guy's I don't know if he's actually Israeli born,
yeah,
but he's certainly Zionist of some sort. And so it's, I think, one of the most sinister psyops I've ever seen, because the idea is to get everyone laughing at people who are effectively, you know, the NRA is quite an important lobby. I'm not saying I totally support the guns, but you know, there's a basic principle in the United States, which was set down right from the beginning, that the state must not have this monopoly on this lethal force power.
Right, exactly.
Because they saw the way it had operated previously, and so we're not going to have it here. And this is really just poking fun at that principle. And so really what he's saying is, I think that the whatever it is in the Constitution, George, you probably know more than I do, some sort of amendment or whatever it is, article, should go. You know, the Americans' rights to guns is just a
second amendment, really, to keep and bear arms,
right.
You know, should not be abridged.
That's the one.
That's it.
So that's how sinister it all is. And I mean, in the bigger... Okay, so that's the psychological operation, massive psychological operation on everyone's TV screens. They're all laughing, they're all poking fun at the wrong people. Yeah, so that's That's how big a psyop it is. Yeah. And also, he's stolen it from a British comedian. I don't know if there's any way that he could sue him for stealing the format. God knows. But in the background to all of this, you know, you've got this building up potential war, like World War III. And I think we really got to start talking about this.
Because, well, you know, he was talking about, look, Trump put forward the idea that Putin is becoming friendly to the Israelis. I never heard that before. Have you?
Yes, I have. Yeah, he is. And he's very wise to be friendly with them.
Well, you know, that Golan Heights oil production is what they're going to protect. See what I mean?
Yeah, I think we've got to be very... I mean, the relationship between Israel and Russia is one of the most delicate in the world. Because the Russians know that the Israelis have been stirring things up in the Middle East, and that the Israelis are the reason why they are now in Syria, and they've had to be drawn into Syria, because otherwise they would have lost their strategic ports in the Mediterranean. And so that relationship is a very, you know, fraught. I would suggest, you know, they're being extremely careful about the way they deal with the Israelis. And of course, the best way to deal with anybody like Netanyahu is to be his best mate, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what they're trying to do. I don't think, you know, we can really draw any conclusions from a picture of Putin and Netanyahu together smiling, really.
Yeah.
Because that is... I mean, it's just like most politicians, you know, which side is lying the most this time?
Right. You know, the Israelis have been sending foreign ministers to Russia in the last year. Did you notice that? There have been several trips by the Israelis to Moscow talking to on high levels.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're trying to stop World War III, basically. I mean, this is what I was saying. You know, you've got a really horrendous situation building in the Middle East all the time. It's building and building.
Right.
With the Saudis and lining up with the Israelis to attack the Iranians, basically. And, you know, all the other states around looking on saying, God almighty, how are we going to stop this? Saudi Arabia is on the brink. I was just seeing the other day that there was some kind of coup attempt in Riyadh. And there was gunfire, and they tried to put it down. There's some news reports saying, oh, it's a drone. But it's not. You know, it's some sort of coup attempt in Saudi Arabia.
Really?
The reason this war in Yemen is going on is because that's effectively it's a civil war. So it's not really Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen. It's Saudi Arabia bombing the Arabian Peninsula, which is the same country. I mean, it's only the Brits that drew up all these dividing lines in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and Yemen is a, you know, is actually a fairly, you know, it used to be just part of Arabia. And so it is a civil war. And there's no news outlet I've heard has talked about it as a civil war, but that's what it is. It's the Saudi royal family trying to subdue the regions of the Arabian Peninsula who they know are not going to support them because these people are too smart and too clever. And in the process, they basically smashed up every single military facility there is in Yemen. There's nothing left, George.
Yeah.
But in terms of World War III, I mean, you know, whether this is going to happen, I don't know. But I think there's a lot of diplomatic effort around the world is looking at this. I mean, we've seen this trade war is another symptom of it.
But it looks like Iran is
trade war is something which is naturally happening.
It looks like,
and this is the way that the Bilderbergers and people like that work, is that they are planning things and then they try and say, oh well, this just happened, you know. Didn't just happen.
It looks like Trump.
It's a result of the completely failed financial system. Now, you know, when you go for printing money, which is what we've been doing since 2008, you have to find some sort of way to say, oh well, it's not our fault. We're going to blame the foreigners, and it's just because, you know, all these cheap foreign imports, and we're going to have to build... Well, yes, you are going to have to build up trade barriers, because, you know, if there is some sort of crash, which is almost inevitable, you've got to have some insulation from the global financial system. You've got to build up your own ability to produce things and feed your population. And, you know, for example, energy. You know, you might not just be able to buy that cheap. If there's any, you know, sort of global conflict, ships will be sinking to the bottom of the sea and they won't arrive, you know, on time. So I think really that's what's going on. And I always try and look at this potential war from the moon. You know, I'm sort of, you can imagine me sitting on the moon and looking at the world, and I see there's a sort of Masonic West, which includes the three most belligerent nations on Earth, which is the United States, Britain and Israel, and on the other hand you've got the Chinese triads. China is becoming extremely authoritarian. Now, if you're a good person and you just carry on, you don't think about politics much, and just go about your day, then you're fine. But if you start to say thought crimes like, oh, the president is no good, and this guy is an egotist, and he's not doing the right thing for the people, we're at the stage now where you can be arrested for saying things like that against President Xi, laughing at the national anthem, all this sort of thing. And the latest is this social credit system they've got, where you cannot travel if you've had some sort of misdemeanor. Now, it's not specified what those misdemeanors are. They can even include crossing the road when the red man is there. You do that enough times, you lose your right to go to work by public transport, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's an authoritarian system, and that, we were talking about the Masons in the United States, UK and Israel, that is the triad secret societies running things over there. So we've got two lots of secret societies. I'm not quite sure which one Henry Kissinger is in, George. Any idea?
Well, Kissinger, he is the guru of foreign policy and what they call realpolitik, okay? At the Bilderberg meetings, it's reported that he gets the big suite, even if there are kings or queens there, okay? So they've looked to him and then presented.
That's right, I've heard that too, yeah.
Yeah, to
yeah, it's all about who is going to sit next to Henry on Thursday night supper.
So he's working with everybody, right? See what I mean? All the heads of all the freaker society and everything else. He's sort of a
broker. I think he's a broker between the...
Yeah.
I mean, he's almost like the modern Aleister Crowley, you know? Remember him from
World War II,
the interwar period?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the guy who is sort of setting up the war, you know, and making it happen in order to loot and steal.
The strategies and policies and stuff, long term.
Basically, that World War II is not about ideology of any sort whatsoever, really. It's about setting up a horrendous, like, dictator of some sort, and then using it as an excuse to go looting. And that's really what it was about, you know. And I think that's probably what we're going to be seeing in the future sometime between these massive superpowers. I mean, this really will be a world war. China and the United States, as major superpowers, get involved in this. And this is why I think, you know, there's a lot of effort going on, particularly by, you know, switched on people in the Middle East to try and make sure it doesn't happen.
Right, right. It's not easy to deal with because they think of Putin as a loose cannon, and also Trump as a loose cannon, not fitting into the New World Order that well. That's a problem, sir.
Well, I wouldn't describe Putin as a loose cannon, because I think, you know, what's happened, you've got this ironic situation where the Russians have got a more functioning democracy than Britain and America, and the Chinese are more successful at capitalism than Britain and America.
Well,
so we've basically been beaten at our own supposed games, you know? I think the interesting thing about Putin is he set up a system over there. Yes, they've got serious problems with organized crime in Russia, but they've got a government now which is fairly democratic, which is very stable, very stable. China, very stable, too. That is not the case in the United States.
It's still authoritarian.
So, you know, they are building their house upon a rock.
Yeah.
Yeah? We are building our houses in the United States and in Britain on shifting sands. This whole business with Brexit, we've got a very complicated electoral situation in the House of Commons, where the voting is not enough for a soft Brexit, which is what Theresa May tried to do the other day, and anyway, the EU don't want it, and not enough for a no-deal Brexit either, which is what quite a lot of people in the Conservative Party want. Well, they don't actually want it, but they're saying, look, anyone that thinks that anything, any deal is going to happen is kidding themselves. And I think that's much closer to the truth. I mean, you know, as someone actually here in Britain, we're the only country that's really been given the opportunity to have a vote on this and for anything to be done about it. And really, I suppose, it's the sort of gangsters in London saying, well, we're fed up with being run by the gangsters in Brussels. But the question is, those powerful gangsters in Brussels might not let the London gangsters get away. You know, that, well, we'll see what happens. But, you know, it could be that there will have to be a general election in the autumn in the UK. And then people will then have to decide again. Do they want, you know, what do they want to do? But it clearly will not be Theresa May leading the Conservative Party into that general election.
Yeah,
because we've got a real,
you see what Trump
a real crisis brewing.
Yeah. Trump goes over there on that Sun interview. My gosh, he doesn't know. He's not a diplomat. He's damn sure not a statesman. Trump is. That's a problem with him. See?
No, well,
he's a,
you know, he's not a great intellect.
No, he's not
a Hillary Clinton. He's not a Hillary Clinton. He's not a liar. You know, he will tell a few lies. He's President of the United States.
He's not a John Kennedy, that's for sure.
As devious as Clinton. Yeah. And also, he's used to dealing with the mob. He's had a whole career with the mob. And he knows how they work. He knows how they operate. And, you know, I suppose in a way he's sort of daring them to blow him away by just saying, I'm going to do what I want, you know. And he's had a whole career of doing this.
Well, the story is that
The thing is with Brexit is it's a key thing, George,
yeah,
as to whether, you know, the degree to which there's going to be a Brexit. I mean, there's loads of people carping on across Britain about the Irish border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK,
right,
and Southern Ireland, which is the Irish Republic, which is staying in the EU. Now, when I lived over there, there was a massive border where the army checkpoints all the way along. And now all they're talking about is a very simple, basic border. But they're just carping about this. There is going to have to be a border if there's going to be a Brexit. I mean, I think that's just basic, simple facts.
Sure, there is.
There's no point in going on about it.
Yeah.
But I think we've really got, I mean, there may well be an election. I'm not saying there will be, but if there is, it looks like there is going to be a no-deal Brexit, that may well precipitate a general election in a way to sort of go back to the public and say, well, this is all they've managed to get is no deal. And is that better than, you know, are you going to accept that, the British public? And they may well just say, no, we don't want that. We'd rather a soft Brexit of some sort. So it's getting all very messy and complicated. And I contrast that with the authoritarian and stable in China and the stable democracy in Russia. If they must be looking at the Brits particularly and Trump and the Americans and saying, what a shambles.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can't call either one of them a democracy. They're all authoritarian, both Russia and China. They're not.
No, I don't agree. You see, I think there's genuine support in Russia for Putin's party. I really do, because I mean, and also it's not just about Putin, right? And this is the key thing. It's not just about him, because if someone shoots him, if he comes to the White House, and the people were saying, "Oh, well, they might shoot him, or they might poison him," you know. If they do, then there's plenty of other people who are just, you know, aligned with him politically. He's made sure that there's loads of people who are similar, and they're very much aware of the international oligarchy that's been trying to subvert their country for many years, that sold off all their industries. You know, we're talking really here about the, you know, the Berezovskis, the oligarchs that came in and they were parasiting off of the dying Soviet Union and just for their own personal benefit. They're very much aware of this in Russia. And so they appreciate somebody like Putin, who, although he is prepared to do deals with the mafia on all sorts of levels, he's found the most dangerous ones and he's taken them out. Actually, Putin is just like us and he's the big boss. But well, the key thing is, George, he's been actually improving the country for the ordinary people, and particularly for the young people. He's given them opportunities in life which they never had under the Soviet system, and they never had under people like Yeltsin. You know, he's actually created, I wouldn't say a miracle, right? It's the wrong word to use, but he's created a much better economic climate for families to thrive and for people to just live their lives and fulfill their potential. So in that way, the people have approved it. So it is a democracy.
But if I had a choice to live where I am or over there, I wouldn't go over there at all. Because we still have protections here.
Have you spent any time in Russia?
Huh?
We
still have protections here that they don't have over there.
George, answer my question. Have you spent any time in Russia?
No, I haven't.
Well, you should do that before you say it, because there's a very... I mean, no, I wouldn't either, largely because of the culture and the language.
Yeah.
But if you have a look at the opportunities offered to the young people, there's just a different mood, yeah? The youngsters are smiling, more happy, you know. They perceive their future and they have a sense of national pride, which is not about lording it over anyone else, but they think, crikey, you know, we're living in a country which is on the up, you know? This country's going places. And it's something which we just don't have in the West anymore, and particularly we don't have since the greatest heist of all time, which was the 2008 robbery that's sometimes called a bailout, you know, of a bunch of corrupt bankers.
Yeah.
So they're slowly killing off this part of the world, whilst Russia has repaid all its Soviet debts, and it's actually a very good place to put your money in safe banks where you'll get interest on it. You know what they've done here, don't you, with the QE and the zero interest rates?
Yeah.
Is you're not allowed to save money and make money by saving money anymore.
Right.
You've got to speculate. You've got to gamble it on the stock exchange, and they are going to crash that stock exchange one day, and you're going to lose everything in their casino. So, you know, this is the difference between the stability, and I would reiterate, democracy of Russia, because Putin has genuine support right across the country for what he's done. One thing they do have also is a pretty good regime of freedom of speech. The Russians have become an example to everybody, I think, that actually even within this gangster-run world, you can still operate a nation with a reasonable amount of success and with a reasonable, you know, intelligent, well-educated population which has got a reasonable amount of public services. Now, I'm not saying I want to move there, no. You know, I'm working in my own country to try and improve things here, you know, and to make people more aware of the various corruption. That's our job as journalists. But, you know, you have to pat, I think, not just Putin, but actually the Kremlin on the back for making a reasonably good job of pulling up their socks after the gangsterism of the Yeltsin era, which was just horrific. I mean, it was just theft of massive public industries, and everybody knows it. And Putin has started to put the country back on its feet with his high-tech hypersonic missile program, for example. You know, they're now in a position to say, look, if you attack us, we're going to take you guys out too. Now, they always could do that with the ballistic missiles, but they've got a whole, you know...
But the economy is not that big economy, Tony. They don't have much of an economy, not really.
That's right. I saw the other day, and I saw this last year too, the last 2 years, they've actually decreased spending on their military. Because they are ready for this. For any conflict, they are now ready for it. And they don't have a whole bunch of greedy gangsters who are just trying to take loads of money into arms countries to develop weapons that aren't actually going to function, like is it called the F-35? This fighter jet if you turn it too fast, the wings snap off. I mean, this is just, you know, this is junk. And they cost something like $10 million a go, these.
Yeah, the corruption here in that area.
The F-35. Yeah, I mean, Britain has committed to buying loads and loads of these bits of flying junk, and, you know, this is the way it operates in over here. It's just basically private businesses making a fantastic amount of money from cajoling and bamboozling and contract fraud, basically, within military procurement.
Right.
And, you know, where our military is actually going to be able to fight, if there is a conflict of some sort, which there obviously is going to be, then they're going to have to use some of this kit, and if it doesn't work, they're going to lose. You know, so I don't think they will be, you know, the World War III is always looming over, but I think a lot of it is gusto and bluster. Because if it really does come to a fight, then I think the Russian equipment will be vastly superior, because it's been produced and developed and researched under a completely different system. It's not been privatised. Over here, almost all of it's been privatised, apart from the procurement itself, which is still in the hands of the Ministry of Defence here in the UK. It's almost all private businesses, and then within those private businesses, the usual sorts of contract fraud.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, it's a mess out there, isn't it, on a world basis, international.
It is, but you know what? Maybe a post 9/11 awareness awakening taking place around the world. Whereas actually what we're getting is our universities and our media is becoming more and more isolated as the only people who are going along with this lie, you know, about 9/11 and about the terrible Muslims.
Yeah.
It's just becoming a sort of a media bubble that not many people really believe in, George. At least that's the way I see it. I mean, you know, just talking to some people the other day here in Bristol, when I was over in Bristol, this is people living on council estate, which is public housing, and they're completely au fait with it. You know, they're oh yeah, we know all about that. We've seen this change. You know, they know all about it. The only people that don't want to talk about it are the elite institutions, because they're just echo chambers for the elite. And this is why Brexit may well precipitate this crash. By the way,
yeah.
If there is a Brexit, it might just literally go crash bang wallop the next day. And of course, if London is still the world's main financial centre. And if there are problems, which there almost certainly will be, if there's no deal and we crash out of the European Union, then this will precipitate the crash. But then the thing is, in a way, you know, you could say, well, better sooner than later. At some point this crash is going to happen. And until it does, all the wealth is being sucked away from poorer people towards the super rich and the banksters. And the sooner that crash happens, the better. And we'll get an economic reset of some kind, even if it's going to be extremely painful. And shares will return to their true value, and property prices will return to their true value, and people will actually start to have to get realistic again. We just need to make sure that we've got some kind of proper regulation in the banking sector, because that just seems to me to be where every country in the West has totally fallen down. We've seen nowhere near enough arrests of auditors and arrests of bankers. They just, you know, they're basically, they've got a get out of jail free card. And these guys are just, you know, basically they're running a racket in every country in the Western world.
Well, did you see the other day where Erdogan is controlling the appointment of the central bank director over there? He's coming in on that now. He doesn't like the way the Central Bank of Turkey has been managed.
Any political leader that wants to run their country has got to make sure that the central bank does what they're told.
That's right.
So the people who are producing the money behave. Because otherwise, the people who produce the money will control the political system. They'll control the criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system in the UK is totally compromised. We've got judges who just come out with ridiculous verdicts, like we had with Cliff Richard the other day, the singer from the 1960s. And there was the BBC reported that his house had been raided, and they also gave him the opportunity to say something. Your house has been raided, have you got anything to say? And that's now been classed as invasion of his privacy. And so he's been awarded £200,000 from the BBC, plus what they believe is around about £3.5 million costs. So we've got ridiculous decisions being handed down by totally crooked judges.
Yeah.
And this one is, you know, basically saying, well, if you're rich and you can pay loads of lawyers, then we will let you sue the BBC and win. You know, any broadcaster, any media person who says something you don't want to say, come to court, give us loads of money, and we'll give you a piece of paper that says that they did the wrong thing and they've got to pay you money and your costs. So it's turned into a totally corrupt system. And the precedent that this sets is unbelievable, George, really, in terms of freedom of the press in Britain.
Right.
It means that the rich and powerful will be able to stop reporting about themselves. So even if something is honest and true, and it happened, and it's real, the BBC will have to say, oh, well, that person's quite rich, maybe we better not report that. Now, how disgusting and appalling is that? I mean, I did an interview on Friday, actually it was on Wednesday, and it was transmitted yesterday on Friday.
Okay.
About with Mark Watts. Mark Watts is one of the best journalists in the country, actually. Okay. I'd like to compliment him. He's one of the top people that you go to if you're a journalist who's having trouble with freedom of information requests. And he will say, oh, you need to do this, you need to do that, and or otherwise he might say, no, you won't be able to get that information because it's exempt or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's dug out fantastic amounts of material over the years, particularly to do with, he's very, very, been very, very good on child sexual abuse. So, in other words, getting government information about, for example, the use of government care homes for sexual abuse and used by the mafia,
okay,
by the mob, for prostitution of underage girls and boys,
right,
from these care homes, this kind of thing. He's dug out fantastic amounts of information about that, and you know, which is appalling, because what you're getting is you're getting kids who've been abused going to the sexually abused, going to the police and saying, I've been sexually abused, and you know what happens next?
Okay.
Their kids get taken away. The kids get taken away straight away. Oh, great. Well, that was helpful. And then sometimes, in some cases, those children have even been given to the people they're accusing of abusing them.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is just an appalling situation. The police, you know, because this is control fraud, really. I mean, it's the people within the block. Of course, obviously, it's serious malfeasance, police corruption, perversion of the course of justice.
Exactly.
You know, these people should be banged up for life. But what they're doing is they're using their power in the police to simply... Well, I mean, it's unspeakable, George, really. You know, that police could do that. You know, actually completely turn the... It's because the infiltration of the police, basically, at the higher levels. So you may get a decent policeman for a little while on your case... All of a sudden they get taken off and you find someone who's actually totally hostile to you, who's working against you, and everything you tell them is being told immediately to your abusers, this kind of thing. And there's a very good, I recommend any of your listeners, do you look up a guy called John Wedger, W-E-D-G-E-R.
Okay.
He was a humble detective constable in Scotland Yard, working on child protection.
Okay.
And John has done several really good talks around the country. You can find them on YouTube. Just describing the way that it works. You know, the way that organized crime has total control and a very, very powerful sway over senior police officers in Scotland Yard, including the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, and the previous guy, Bernard Hogan Howe. These people... closed down inquiries into child sexual abuse, removed the best detectives from those cases, etc., etc. And so, you know, those senior police should go to jail, actually. That's where they should be right now. But there's no effective criminal justice system in the UK, I'm afraid. And, you know, the fact that they don't take abuse of children seriously should be a bit of a warning alarm bell, because they've been doing it for years. It's just the internet has helped expose a lot of this stuff, George.
Oh, God. What about this poisoning over there, this second Novichok poisoning?
Well, I shouldn't laugh because someone's dead. Look, okay, so this is my territory, George. I told you, I think, you know, a few months ago.
Yeah.
I worked for the BBC in Salisbury.
Okay.
A year. You know, it's a very, very highly militarised area. One thing that's not been told about the second two people is that their families were, almost all of the members of their families were working for the military.
Oh, okay.
And there's two military secret bases, well, there's loads of secret bases, obviously, but
okay,
the two most important are Boscombe Down, which is the RAF's main test flying place, and it's also one of the longest runways in the country, just
okay,
outside Salisbury, and the other one is... Portland Down, which is this chemical weapons base. Well, why has Britain even got a chemical weapons base? We shouldn't have any chemical weapons base. All these things have happened. Ainsbury is about 3 miles from Portland Down. Salisbury is about 6 miles from Portland Down. So both of these places are in this little circle, tiny little circle around Britain's main chemical weapons centre and biological weapons. So it's Portadown. It's almost certainly where this so-called Novichok, if it ever existed, has come from. Yeah, so though that hasn't been hardly mentioned at all, but the people were, I mean, they were homeless. As I understand it, both of them heroin addicts, and it was interesting because I had a look at an old edition of the Salisbury Advertiser, the Swindon Advertiser. We call it the Adver in Wiltshire.
Okay.
And the Advertiser had come out with a fascinating little bit of story early in July. I think it was just before this happened anyway. Maybe it was middle of June or something, before this second so-called poisoning happened. And they were saying that there is this, I think it's called Tremadol or something, I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, it's a very dangerous form of artificial, chemically made heroin.
Okay.
And it's extremely dangerous. And the police put out a public notice saying, watch out for this stuff. I think that's what they had. I think that's probably what they had. A bad dose of heroin of some sort. And that's initially, for the first 3 days, that's what the police were treating their illness as. And then suddenly it all switched, and no, it's Novichok. Well, okay, so one of them's dead, but, you know, the other one's now walked out of hospital yesterday. That wasn't Novichok. Novichok kills you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not Novichok. Whatever he had, it wasn't that. And we're also told to believe that this gel was found in a perfume bottle which was left in one of the parks in Salisbury.
Okay.
I mean, if you believe that, you believe anything. This stuff degrades.
I know, it's crazy.
It won't be potent after a certain period of time, like days and weeks. And this is months and months afterwards. You know, the idea that you can, because it's a binary chemical, so you have to mix two chemicals to make it.
Right.
And they react, and then you get your Novichok. But it doesn't last forever, it will degrade. So, you know, we're being fed a whole load of nonsense. And we even had a situation on Wednesday. I've never seen anything like it, actually. It's clear and obvious news management, which is in a massive alarm bell. It should be. It certainly is for anyone that's worked in the press, like I have. Is that you had between 8 a.m. and midday on the BBC, they had this story which had been circulating on the Press Association and on CNN, which was that the perpetrators of the Skripal attack had been identified using facial recognition software. Now, I just see this. I mean, you know, it proved at 1 p.m. to be rubbish. We were told by the security minister that this was nonsense, this story. Is in the, wild speculation department, yeah?
Right.
So that was Ben Wallace, the security minister, tweeted this next to the Press Association's tweet about the story. So you've immediately, the whole story is undermined by the security minister saying halfway through the day, no, this is nonsense. So that's the sort of crazy thing we're dealing with now, is there'll be it's almost like an advert for the facial recognition software, you know.
Right.
Hey everyone, look, this facial recognition software has solved the crime.
Oh,
we've discovered it's the Russians. Ha ha, look.
Yeah.
Dastardly Russians. And, you know, there's no actual evidence for it. And anyway, the original story wasn't sourced. Anonymous sources say, it's all denied. It's denied, denied, denied officially. But still, these various newspapers, we even had a paper the next day, The Eye, the despicable editor of The Eye, even printed it as the main story, even though it had been, the security minister had said it wasn't true.
Okay.
So, or at least that there was no evidence for it. That this is just speculation. So they printed it as a factual story on the front page of the next day's paper. This whole business is just a part of this Operation Beluga again.
Right.
Beluga, Beluga. This is what I keep thinking of when I see every time they try and discredit the Russians. I mean, this isn't new, is it? They've been trying to discredit Russia since Napoleon.
Right. So you're up. Hey, Tony, we got about 2 minutes left. Tell the listening audience how to contact you and your programs and stuff.
The show, if you're interested in what's going on in Bristol, we've got loads of little scandals we keep digging out, like the mayor. Bristol's mayor, Marvin Rees, his father, Valentine Walker, was a gangster. He was apparently the first person, we were told, whether this is true or not I don't know, to bring crack cocaine into the city. His father also was involved in a machete attack, and which ended up with the leader of the anti-apartheid movement in Bristol, who was named Kuumba Balogun, being driven out of the city, driven out of the country. He's now living in Ghana. So the mayor is, you know, his father, of course, it's not, he can't visit the sons of the father on the son, or the sins of the father on the son.
Right.
But, you know, it certainly looks as if there is quite a close gangster connection to running the city, you know, at the moment. And the same sort of thing happens in the BBC. We've got one of their main presenters, Emma Barnett. I think she's on maternity leave at the moment, but she's the daughter of one of the biggest gangster families in Manchester, who were running brothels. So the gangsters are in the driving seat. And if you look around you, you can see more and more kind of society starting to mimic gangsterism.
Man.
So, yeah, we're online at thisweek.org.uk, where you can listen to the previous shows. We have story links. The last show we did had a real good look at the US role in creating Zionism and creating the State of Israel, with a wonderful lady who works with a campaign, a very small campaign. Maybe you can have a chat with her sometime, George, if you haven't already.
Okay.
It's called If Americans Knew.
Okay.
If Americans Knew. And, you know, she did a fantastic job and explained the something. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of them. It's called the Perushim, which is the secret society which was used in the United States to lobby in the late 1800s for the Zionist state, even though none of the Jews at the time wanted it.
Right.
So, but it was a question of, well, we're going to have to do it. And it was one of the Supreme Court judges who was secretly running the entire Zionist campaign, even though he was supposed to have resigned from it.
Oh,
you know, he
man.
Had a special little anteroom he was running the campaign from. Anyway, that's Alison Weir. Alison, W-E-I-R, and her campaign and her website is called If Americans Knew.
Okay.
And I think she's done a fantastic job and written a terrific book all about America's secret role in creating the Israeli state. You know, so it wasn't just the Brits, it was you guys too.
Okay, well, Tony, thank you very much this evening. We've got to go. But, boy, I'll tell you what, you're full of good information, but thank you very much, Tony.
I do hope so, George. God bless, and
okay.
Thank you very much for at least taking the time to listen.